of crap.
This brings up a good topic. When you DM, is there a favorite shirt you like to wear, and what is it?
No.
No. Okay, that's no. Who's that?
I usually am DMing in my face-to-face games on Fridays after work, so I'm wearing whatever I wore to work that day, which is usually like a button-up shirt and a pair of dark jeans. So,
wow,
you're
I'm just kidding. Your girly shirt. Now, what does that mean?
Well,
like,
anything
is
that's
like a unicorn on it or something, or
no.
Okay.
Is it low cut?
Not too low. But low enough.
Low enough that it has a charm aura.
just how low. Yeah.
I like that. That's right where we went, guys. That's right where we went.
Yeah.
Well, she was.
See, I'm innocent. I said nothing at all.
We're keeping it classy here. So.
I am doing my best too.
Good luck with that.
Yeah.
No, see, I do. I have a black shirt, black T-shirt, and green and neon green writing in there. Up in the left breast, it says, "Your opinion, although interesting, is irrelevant."
Okay, see, that's a good
DM shirt. I have to give you that.
Yeah.
See, Believe it or not, my wife picked that out. That was not mine. My wife picked that shirt out for me, so there you go.
I usually wear whatever's clean, which sometimes means reaching into the big giant box of D20 shirts that I have.
I think I'm going to decline getting a shirt to fit.
I was just thinking maybe I'll put that in the washer real quick, you know?
Well, I'm not gonna sell anything I've worn. My T-shirt collection grows every time I haven't done the laundry by one. So.
That was really funny because normally when I DM, I'm wearing, like I said, like a button shirt, like a collared shirt, you know, because when I teach, I wear a collared shirt. And so one of my players had a job interview one time and he came to the game and he was wearing like a button up shirt and a pair of slacks. And he walked in, and normally he's wearing like a T-shirt or a polo shirt and a pair of jeans or shorts. And he walked in and everybody sort of looked at him strange and he goes, "What? I came to the game as DM Samuel tonight."
So you made him DM on the spot, right?
Exactly.
Nice.
I said, "Oh, here, I'll sit down then."
The other shirt I like to wear is I got one of the bowling shirts that says Dungeon Master on it when I did the RPGA games at PAX East, and I'll wear that sometimes.
Okay, nice. Now see, that's a good DM shirt, yeah.
Yeah,
I still haven't figured out exactly what a girly shirt is. So, I mean, the buttons are on the wrong side, but other than that, I don't know what a girly shirt is.
Usually they're pink and they have kittens on them.
Exactly. Sometimes, sure. Okay. That's the best way. Okay.
Sometimes unicorns, but I can stress, and I do that a guy's shirt can have unicorns on it too.
Kittens or Hello Kitty?
1977, but yeah.
Oh, no, Hello Kitty. But I guess I'm supposed to refer to everything as puppies, so.
Oh, really?
Right, yeah.
The Gen Con, yeah.
To in an effort to not make anyone jealous, they have started, instead of saying Gen Con, they just refer to puppies.
Spartonius had started that, yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah, I saw that too. But that's not what I think of when I hear that term, so I just... That
yeah.
So.
but
anyway.
There's no need to describe my shirts. It's just whatever.
No, wait, she says after we just spent 5 minutes talking about them.
This is going down as like the least interesting DM podcast ever.
It's the least, RPG focused podcast ever.
They're like, I'm gonna hear about dungeon mastering and some tips, and I'm gonna learn how to do this, and it's I learned what to wear.
Oh yeah, we're talking about shirts.
Hey, every aspect of DMing, you know, it doesn't have to be the hard and fast rules. These are insights into actual DMs. So now you're getting a little bit of psychology and a little bit of what's it like to be a DM.
Well, when I'm killing my players, I like to be as comfortable as I possibly can.
That's right. So I wear BVDs.
Oh my gosh.
What were you saying, Tracy?
That's like an old
commercial. I was going to say, this is what happens when you have me speak more in the podcast.
Yeah.
We're okay with that.
Yeah, we're good.
We'll probably actually pick up a few more listeners this way, so.
Yeah.
Okay, so speaking of being a real DM.
Thad, wait a minute. Before you start, you'll have to start this one with wow, 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 wow.
DM's Roundtable Podcast. It's a podcast about nothing.
Yes, right.
That music's for Thursday night. That's my Thursday night game.
No, that's a little more like bow, chicka, bow, wow.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We need sound effects. We need someone who can just press a button and make sound effects, because that would just make us completely cheesy.
I do a fair Murloc, but that's about all I can do. So
that wouldn't put us over the edge after our wardrobe discussion.
Yeah.
No.
Anyway, so to get into a real DM topic, so last night I DM'd a game. And, you know, there's always tips and tricks and stuff about how to speed along a combat. And one of the big ones is make alternate win scenarios, you know. Always have different ways the party can win. Either capture an objective or defeat certain enemies in a certain order or, you know, pass a skill challenge where they're fighting and that gives them an alternate route to victory instead of just kill all the enemies on the board. And right. So last night I started a fight and in the encounter with my players, there were actually a few different scenarios in which they could win. And I didn't tell them that. I didn't make it completely obvious, but, you know, there was at least three different ways they could win besides just clearing all the enemies off the board. And so it was a really tough fight, and they didn't do any of those things. They didn't look at any options outside of just straight attacking the enemies. And they didn't have any good tactics. They all fought someone different. You know, the tank ran into the middle of a big group. The Avenger went after one of the elites, which didn't work out well for him. And, you know, one guy who used to be a barbarian who just started playing a druid really didn't get the feel for his character. So he stood back for a while and didn't do a lot. But they had terrible tactics and they didn't look for any opportunities to win. And so they almost got completely destroyed. And then they finally figured out, one of them has actually been reading the player's strategy guide. And so they, you know, he finally was like, okay, we need to start killing these guys one by one. And so probably about 45 minutes into the combat, they started taking out the enemies one by one, and they finally hit one of the conditions, the early win conditions. And so I had the enemies start pulling out and started to retreat. But that just made the party split up even more and kind of go one-on-one as they each kind of tried to stop the enemies from retreating because they just wanted to kill everyone on the board. So it turned the combat, it could have been over at about the 45-minute mark, and it turned the combat into almost a two-hour long encounter because they wouldn't let the enemies escape and they wouldn't let the combat end early. So,
well, can I ask you a question?
Fire away.
Did they have any clues or any hints that there would be alternate win conditions for this particular encounter?
Other than the fact that there are usually alternate win situations in my encounters, and they've encountered them before.
Okay. So the answer is yes, they did have clues.
Okay. Well, let me ask you a question, it's a reasonable expectation
that they would assume that there would be alternate win conditions because there often are.
Right. And it's not as if I try not to start it out by saying, okay, guys, you're now in an encounter, and here are the four ways you can win. Because that's not usually how encounters should work, at least not to me. I don't want to have to hit them over the head with every win scenario possible.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a question. What was the context of the encounter? I mean, where was it at? Who were they fighting and that sort of thing? Just a real brief overview.
It was a 4-on-4 fight. It was an ambush. They were actually basically picnicking behind a pub. They were having a merry old time sipping some beers, and so I thought that was a great time to bring a protagonist in and beat the crap out of them.
Okay. And I'm asking because, especially since you said they started to pull back, one thing I've noticed both as a player and a DM is that if the players feel that letting enemies get away is going to bite them in the ass later, they'll do as much as they possibly can to keep them from
getting away. Yep, that's been my experience as well.
I've never had a luck as a DM really getting players to leave enemies alone if they're running. And as a player, I pretty much do the same thing. If I see someone running and there's the possibility that they could go and warn somebody or bring back reinforcements, I don't want to let them go. So retreating is something that, that doesn't seem to work a whole lot in a lot of games. I mean, if anybody's got any good ideas for it, I'm willing to listen.
Well, I actually ran a game last night, and I had someone run away, and it actually worked. But it was a very sort of specific situation in which it worked.
As a player we were definitely focused elsewhere.
But that's what I was going to say is that the situation is a very specific. It wasn't a general, oh, they defeated enough enemies that the rest of them tried to retreat. It was they're preoccupied elsewhere, and another enemy combatant comes on the scene, does a sneak attack, and then runs off before anyone really has time to figure out what's going on.
And it says a lot that if it weren't as late as it were, we were going to go after and hunt him down too. So
yeah.
It still would have ended up being a chase scene. It just would have been a slightly different one.
See, if the only way to end encounters early by giving alternate options for victory is to basically have the enemies surrender, I know my players, and I know they're not going to let any of them survive. So that means, A, never bringing back any of those enemies for another encounter, which is fun. And B, you deal with the fact that your players are going around wholesale slaughtering people who have either surrendered to them or have lost in a fight to them. And that's, to me, that's no fun. Especially since they're in the middle of one of the most heavily populated cities in this whole area. I'm supposed to just let them kill four or five people in cold blood and then not have them deal with the ramifications of that. You know, they don't deal with the guards. They don't get kicked out of the city, because if they did, they'd be pissed. But they're...
See, now, Thad, the way I handle that myself is that I will occasionally play their conscience, and I will go and say and my characters are pretty good about this. They don't, because you're right, I will occasionally shorten fights myself by having certain members surrender, and they're usually the puny guys that are, the big boss. They've either targeted right away and killed him, or he's like had other means of escape, trap door, poof, teleport, whatever. But and that's rare that happens. But when it does, it does. But when somebody surrenders, if they go, well, let's just slit his throat, I will raise an eyebrow first. Now I'll just do that. I'll look right at the player, and I'll just raise an eyebrow, and I will say, are you sure you want to do that? Now, if they're in the middle of a dungeon somewhere deep in the underground, I can't say anything about it. If they do it, they're fine. There's not going to be any witnesses. But like you said, in the middle of a town, oh, someone will see it. And then someone will talk. And the players then had better have a very, very good excuse of why they just, in cold blood, killed this being, person, whatever. But anyway, it creates a role playing opportunity in my situation, and so they'll actually role play that out and would rather and sometimes enjoy those things more often than just we had to kill the guy and take their stuff, But
Tracy, yeah, well, it, say I mean, some, wait, wait, wait.
The
wait,
end
wait.
Of the fight broke down to one of the last enemies finally.
I was just saying XP. That's a good reason.
But see, my players know that if they win in combat, even if it's not killing all the enemies, they get the experience for defeating the enemies. So it's not like slitting throats is going to get you more XP.
Yeah.
Well, and but what
once you've won, you've won. But, you get that experience for beating them.
But what do you do when you don't award? You don't necessarily award XP.
Yes.
Per encounter. Yes. Hello.
Whoa. That was fast. I'm sorry. What did you just say?
What?
You lagged out really bad there, Sam.
That must have been my computer or something. What do you do in the case when you don't necessarily give XP on an encounter by encounter level? Because I don't always give XP as, oh, well, this encounter was worth 300 XP per person, and so they're going to level in, four encounters, blah, blah, blah. I often level them after they have completed some portion of the adventure or some number of quests, or they have encountered some number of important events that to me says, okay, they're ready to go to the next level. It's not necessarily a pure XP thing. So my award system in my games isn't always necessarily XP bound. So it's always the case that XP is the best reward for a situation.
Well, and that's the thing. That should mean that they won't be enticed to slit throats just to get that extra XP.
Yeah, exactly. It shouldn't make a difference either way. If you give it out, if you give the experience out by the encounter, they get the experience whether they kill everything or not. And if you're not giving it out by the encounter, they're still going to level up at the rate that you feel is appropriate. So,
For me, it's just the problem of there are players who complain about combat being too long and about wanting more combat. You know, lately I've only been able to get one or two combats in per session, and I know my players want more. And so the idea is, okay, I'm giving you more. Ah, we lost Randall. I'm giving them the option. I'm giving them the ability to get out of combat quicker so then we can move on with the story and then get into more. But they aren't taking that bait. And then
one thing I might suggest, and I haven't done it myself, but I've seen people suggest it, is do it narratively. I mean, when you get to the point where it's pretty much obvious that the characters are going to win, give them a short description of how they just won. I mean, they spent, you know, the next couple of minutes mopping things up, but it was no longer really in doubt. And just basically call the fight as soon as it's a lost cause for the NPCs. Like I said, I haven't tried that myself, but a lot of people seem to swear by it.
I haven't done that. The only problem I could see with that is some of the more rules intense players in the party wanting to know why they weren't able to chase down and kill the enemy that I said got away. Like, the combat's over, this enemy got away. I could easily see at least two of the players in my group right now saying, well, I'm an Avenger who pursues, and, you know, I have all these movement powers. Why couldn't I catch up to her and kill her? And, I mean, to lay down the scenario, they were fighting an elite and a solo and then two very low-level mobs. And, I mean, one of the scenarios for quick win, which they finally figured out, was they killed the two smaller mobs, or the smaller monsters, and that caused the solo to basically decide this fight wasn't worth it, and she started to back out. So they started chasing the elite and the solo as they split up, and it ended up that the Avenger was fighting this single solo, and the solo still had like 60 hit points, and the Avenger had 9. And she had chased her into the city street and was about to kill her in the middle of the street while this solo was basically – it was a female, and she was screaming that these people were trying to kill her. So there was no thought about what was going to happen to the group. My players just become bloodthirsty and they want to kill everything. Wow. And then they want to complain later that there's not enough combat and that combat goes too long. So
Wait.
Okay. I'm going to start moderating this session because Tracy has tried to jump in like 5 times and everybody keeps talking over her, including myself. So Tracy, what did you want to say?
It's okay. Oh, no, I was just saying, I actually have the same exact problem that Thaddeus does. And my group does not like to let the monsters get away, regardless of if there's a good story reason. And in fact, my husband just is making a hand signal like, yeah. So they do not like them to get away. If I let them interrogate them, then they're usually happy ending combat early. But if the guy is just going to get away and they don't get a chance to interrogate or loot the body, they're just not interested.
I don't want to end every combat with interrogation. I know. I will pull my own hair out to get away from that. I mean, that is...
Yeah, not something I'd look forward to either.
I guess it's a pretty common thing, though, because I think Greg Bilson talked about it at PAX East a little bit, too, that PCs basically turn into the worst bloodthirsty monsters there are during the game and everything. I don't know what the solution is other than just say, sorry, guys, they're gone. They ran away.
Well, this – I know Aaron wants to talk, so we'll let Aaron go, and then I'll –
One thing I had in mind – I haven't really had the opportunity yet – is to let them almost run it like a almost like a impromptu skill challenge to try and catch or block off people from escaping. So it lets the players still continue to be involved to make choices, to roll dice without the intensive details of straight up combat. So you can run it like a chase. You can run it like, you know, hide and seek almost as people try to get away. And that would keep the players involved. That would keep them, you know, interested in it more than if you just said, okay, these two guys got away. You managed to catch these guys. What are you going to do with them or whatever?
But that again brings us back to the situation where every combat has the potential to end up in interrogation, which I'm fine with doing interrogation every once in a while, but I do not want every, I'll get rid of combat if every combat ends in interrogation.
I completely agree. And I wish I had some other kind of solution. It's, the only thing I could think of is to have enemies that more enemies that you really can't interrogate, like constructs or elementals or whatever. But even that's kind of a band-aid on the situation and not so much a real solution.
Well, here's what I'm thinking. There's a game that I just started playing called The Dresden Files, and it uses a system called compels, which basically if your character does something that's against what they normally would do, or if something comes up in a situation and they have a an aspect that basically would lead you to believe that they would act in a certain way in a certain situation, you can basically compel them to act that way, or they start taking, you know, they have to spend fate points in this game. In D&D, I would look at that saying, okay, I require my players to be a good alignment because I'm tired of playing with unaligned characters who walk through cities just killing people wholesale.
Well, So what I was going to say actually was the answer to your problem was throw an alignment foundation back into your game.
Right,
I know, but you've been talking now and you're not following the moderator list on the chat.
You said I was next.
Right, and then you talked and then Aaron talked and then you talked again. I'm just giving you a hard time. Go ahead.
No, I'll stop talking. That's fine.
No, go on. Go.
No, I'm done.
Okay, well, now I feel like a dick.
Okay, good. So my cue then. So,
yeah, go for it.
Thaddeus brings up a good point with the Dresden Files and the Compel, and that is sort of what I do but from a D&D perspective. Some of my players are good, some are unaligned. The ones that are good have a tendency to leave the unaligned one, I mean, to watch the unaligned one's behavior. And if something gets questionable, then, like, for example, the paladin of the group will step up, or even the warlord, who plays more like a paladin than he is an actual warlord. And he will say, you know, let's not do it this way or whatever. And if I don't want an interrogation, my monsters become strangely suicidal. So a lot of times they will pretend like they're being captured and then all of a sudden burst into activity, in which case everyone just gangs up on them and kills them, which is pretty quick. Or they flat out will, you know, for the glory of whoever, and then, you know, and kill themselves, and in which case they get no information out of them. So anyway, may not be the most glamorous solutions in the world, and there may be better ways around that, but I think in most encounters, if you are whatever that means, but I think there's ways to mitigate it, so it's not the same ending over and over and over again.
So before we go any farther forward, did we have someone join? Did Mark join on the...
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, so say hi to everybody, Mark, and tell us who you are so people can get a feel of your voice.
My name's Mark Hertog, and I just play D&D and starting to play Dresden Files.
Okay.
Now, Mark, are you a... Are you on Twitter or are you in like Dad's Game?
I am in DM Samuel's game on Monday nights online, and also on Twitter I'm Jester OC.
Oh, okay. Now I'm connecting the name with the name.
Yeah, I have the biggest problem with names and, you know, online PCs, real names, and Twitter accounts. I have a real tough time with it, so maybe I should just change my name on Twitter. Or I'll just change my name to Jester. I'll just go by Jester at work and say, hey, just call me Jester. It's a lot easier.
Well, if you ever saw Top Gun, that's not necessarily a bad thing, so.
Exactly.
I think there's a lot more discussion going on in the chat right now than in the actual podcast, so.
Well, now we're all being really sensitive about the flow, so.
No, we'll just keep pushing forward. It's all right. I'll just stop talking. I talk too much, apparently.
Let me go into the aspects and the compels thing. It's not something that other games haven't tried before. I know in Mutants and Masterminds, the GM could basically pay players to have something happen narratively, and they would get a bonus from it. A Trail of Cthulhu, not Call of Cthulhu, but Trail of Cthulhu has something similar where the GM can basically tell you, this is what your character's motivation is. You need to follow that motivation. And in return, they basically regain some sanity or the sanity analog. So the aspect thing and the compels isn't new, but it's definitely something that would be nice to incorporate more fully into D&D. Because, like you said, players really do become bloodthirsty monsters when it comes down to combat, hunting down people to the very end. So, Tracy, did you have something to say?
Yeah, I was just wondering if you do the compels, or even if you try to enforce alignment, how do you get around the fact that the players are probably going to turn it around and say, "You can't tell me how my character would act."
Well, go ahead, Thaddeus.
Oh, well, my answer for that would be easily that you've already told me how your character would act in a general sense by declaring what your alignment would be. And since at the beginning of the character creation, you know, there was an understanding that no one would play an evil or really, really terribly bent unaligned character. I'll let them play unaligned as long as they promise that it's, you know, kind of like the neutral good of olden days. But that agreement was part of a social contract made in the game before we started, and so they have already told me how their character would act in a situation like that, and that.
Well, I was gonna say, but didn't you? If you tell them they can only play good characters, you've told them how their characters would act.
Right, but I've also told them, you know, it's a game. There are contracts, social contracts that you make when you step into that game. That there are rules, and you know, being tired of the players who just walk around killing everyone at will and setting up a structure to get around that is part of the rules of the game.
But I guess the point with that is, well, then why even have alignments if everybody has to be good, right? If you're going to mandate that the part of the social I'm not saying you can't or that it's bad, but if you're going to mandate that part of the social contract, if they're playing with you as the DM, is that they have to have a good aligned character, then you're not giving them the option of having any sort of conflict in terms of good versus bad, because they're going to have to conform to the idea of playing a generally good character, which is not necessarily a bad thing, right? Because, you know, constraints actually tend to make people more creative, which is one of those paradoxical things that turns out to be true. But I see what Tracy's asking is, if you're telling them they've got to be good, you're telling them how to play their character.
I have an answer for that. I think I kind of meet it halfway. When I start my game, I encourage my players, I tell them, look, no evil characters. You know what evil is. Wanton killing, raping, pillaging, etc. is evil. Get that through your head now. Doesn't matter who you're doing it to, it's still evil. Now, once I've set that baseline, there are going to be situations that come up in the game that they may commit or want to commit what would generally be considered an evil act. And I will look at them and I'll say, are you sure you want to do this? I go, and then I'll say, what is your alignment? And they'll tell it me. They'll either say unaligned or good, and say, and why are you doing this? And I actually, you know, I force the player to come and tell me. I don't say no, but I, you know, because that's the big, you know, that's a big rule. You don't really want to say no, but you do want to try to get the player to give you every reason in the world what just, I make them rationalize their actions. And so, you know, and I said, and if I have to, I'll say, you don't expect consequences for this. And things happen later down the line. I will deliberately, I mean, I've made the world. It's my world. And if they're going to give it the stink eye, then it's going to come back at them one way or the other. And so, sure, go ahead and commit that act now, and then later on you'll see what happens, you know. And my players know this. And so they usually behave as per their alignment as close as they can. So they don't end up on a rampage. They know it's not like a video game where you kill everything and you get the XP. It's not like that. And, you know, they know that they don't kill peasants and things like that and commoners and stuff, because that's not, you know, it goes back to Thaddeus, the social contract that he was talking about. So, but anyway, that's kind of a long-winded answer, but that's how I've handled it in my games in the past.
Yeah, I agree with Randall. I think it's better if the society in your game deals with it more than just telling your players how they can and cannot act their characters. Because even the best good character will occasionally do something that apparently is against type, just because there could be something in their backstory that says, like, there's no other way that they could act other than in a quote-unquote evil manner in this particular case.
Well, right, and one of the things I was going to say is that extreme cases are okay, and stepping outside of a good alignment, or what you would quote-unquote justify as a good alignment, every once in a while is fine. I mean, I'm not saying don't kill enemies, don't kill anybody. You have to love puppies and not hurt anyone. But you know,
I
understand the complaint of, you know, you're basically telling your players how to make their characters. But if it's just alignment, I've heard that argument, I've heard that complaint, and I've let people get away with it before. And all it ends up with is players who, you know, kill, rape, and pillage everything they see, and then end up backstabbing their party members because they're like, hey, that's what my character does. And so, you know, I set these rules up, and it seems like almost every time I've allowed for deviation, I've wound up either kicking a guy out or having him make a new character, because they're kids. You put an evil character in the hand of a player, and we're already on the subject that players run off and kill everything that fights them. They won't let anything get away. So then you say, okay, now you're evil. You know, that means you can do whatever you want. And so then they just go off and kill everything. I mean, it's just, maybe I don't have enough faith in humanity, but let's let Mark get a word in.
You know, I was thinking we normally in our group, we don't have an issue too much of evil players, but we definitely have the fangs out, feel the blood and they really want it. The, you know, part of the aspect, what we normally come across is if it's too much stress on me as trying to, okay, these guys are always being bloodthirsty. I normally, after the game or usually before, I try to establish, you know, what I'm expecting, because I'm a player. I mean, I'm the DM 99% of the time, but I'm allowed to have fun too. And if it starts getting to the point where, you know, it's messing with me, I think it's, you know, I'm obligated to talk to him first and say, look, you know, I don't want to go the route of saying the police or the city guard are going to be stepping in and taking control. Because it's really not fun as a player. I mean, I've been there and had the city guard just, you know, I'm 7th level and they just happen to be 12th, you know. It's really not a fun dynamic when I've been there. So I try to handle most of that stuff offline. And usually it goes pretty well that they kind of, you know, see the stress it's putting on me and tone it down a bit. But that's just my group.
I guess my point was, if you really want alignment to play a difference or to play a part in your game, it needs to be more than just a word. So, you know, fourth edition, you know, doesn't really, fourth edition Dungeons and Dragons doesn't really have alignment. I mean, it's got it in name, but it really doesn't have any mechanics in place to really do anything about that. It's completely reliant on the DM to, as Tracy said, make the society have the players conform to what their stated supposed alignment is. But there's really no mechanic there in place. So if the DM isn't really paying that much attention or isn't really enforcing it, then why shouldn't the players become bloodthirsty? Or, you know, if it's not going to be enforced, then what's the point of even having an alignment? It's just a word. So, you know, if you want your players to, instead of chasing down every single little goblin, if you want them to act a certain way, it needs to have stated consequences and it needs to have a mechanical, you know, rule in the game that has consequences rather than just, oh, well, you have to play a good aligned character and here's generally how they act. Well, you know, and as far as I'm concerned too, evil characters actually have some value if it's in the story correctly. Not everybody can do that. Not every player can do that and make it so that it actually makes sense. But, you know, you can be evil and manifest certain behaviors that others would consider evil, but you might make very moral choices in the meantime. It needs to be more well-defined if it's going to have consequences and it's going to be a part of your game.
Yeah, I think the big thing is just that most players get annoyed whenever DMs tell them, hey, that doesn't match your alignment, because it's the DM telling them what their character is and isn't doing. And I think that's why they took out a lot of the framework around alignment in 4th edition.
Well, that's why I enjoy the Compel system and the Dresden Files, and we'll talk about that in a second.
Yeah, before we get back to that, let me just make one statement real quick. If it's continually being a problem with characters acting in that bloodthirsty or non-heroic way or a way that you as the DM don't particularly want to see your game go, you can take it outside of the game. Ask your players why they act that way and see what their expectations are. If it's for the XP, you can explain to them. If you do award it on an encounter-by-encounter basis rather than an enemy-by-enemy basis, you can explain that. You can explain what other system you may have set up. But this is, I mean, if it's really becoming a problem, take it outside of the game. Take it out of character. Discuss it and try to come to an agreement that everybody can live with. Because there are going to be people that are going to want to kill everything regardless. But there are some people that are going to have they're going to have an in-character reason for killing everything, or they're going to have an in-character reason for doing what they're doing. And if you can all get on the same page with that, you can probably find a way to make everything run smoothly for everybody. And then there's silence.
That's right.
You know what? You have such a powerful argument.
You emphasize what I said that I do at the beginning of my game with all my players. So, I mean, yeah, that's basically what you have to do. You're absolutely right. So about those Dresden Files, that is.
Yeah. Well, I was just looking at something. There's after the show, you guys will have to watch it. There's a little like skit short online show that sprung up about D&D a little while ago. It's called the Meta Game Show. And they did an episode called TPK, and you can find it on YouTube. It describes almost to a T what happened to not the players I'm playing with now, but the people I played with prior to them, which caused me to basically dissolve the game, stop DMing for a little while, and go back to just playing and working. I would suggest everybody go watch that because it's freaking hilarious, and it really is almost exactly the story of what happened to my last party of evil characters.
Can't wait to take a look at that.
Yeah, it ended with combat of two of the players killing two of the other players, and then one other player getting mad about that and trying to kill them, and then the enemies killed everybody, and then it was bad.
It was a nightmare.
Oh, wow.
And then everybody was mad at the end because he was like, well, why would that happen? Why would you let that happen? And I was just like, he's evil and he said he wanted to fight you. I don't know. I'm new. I'm a very new DM. Yeah, so the Dresden Files. Moving past this. Who here wants to explain what the Dresden Files is? Because I don't.
Modern fantasy role-playing. Urban fantasy role-playing.
Yeah, that pretty much sums it up.
I mean, well,
that sums up the setting.
It's based on a series of novels by Jim Butcher. I think they've got 10 novels now, a series of short stories, even a couple of graphic novels. It is, like Randall said, urban fantasy role-playing. It's got a definite emphasis on investigation and the magic as opposed to combat, though combat does take place, and it's an important aspect of it as well.
And the game is a fate-based game, which is a game system based around the idea of compels and fate points, which is basically what we were talking about earlier. And that's all layered over the fudge system, which is a very simple dice rolling system. It does away with pretty much every dice except for some modified D6 dice. Uh-oh. Looks like Tracy has to go back to the Gen Con revelries.
Yeah, or just, get some sleep.
Good luck with that.
What do you have planned for tomorrow?
A lot of just trying to track people down and hang out with them. The con itself starts on Thursday, so not sure what tomorrow's plans are yet. But I also have to plan my Thursday night game.
What is your Thursday night game? You've talked about that a couple times, but you haven't explained.
It's a game at Hooters that I'm running.
Tracy's blush. She's starting to blush now. So.
Yes. It's like some sort of co-ed bachelor party thing. It's going to be very, very fun.
The work is epic.
It's going to be epic, according to my husband. Yeah, it's going to be a twisted fairy tale. I don't know exactly what we're doing yet because I haven't planned it. But I was asked about a week ago to do this, so kind of doing it last minute. Go ahead.
I just think it sounds like it's going to be the coolest game ever. It pretty much is the single reason now that I wish I could go to Gen Con is D&D with Tracy at Hooters.
Right.
That would be awesome.
It is going to be a lot of fun. I think.
Record it.
I don't know. I mean, so I don't know if those people are going to be very comfortable being recorded.
Don't tell them. No, I'm kidding.
Sure they will.
Just sneak a mic in under a stack of books. And
yeah. Well, one of the guys is Jarrett Van Hindman, who, does a lot of really cool stuff, arts and stuff. And then a few other people. It's going to be pretty cool. And I can't forget to pimp Michael Robles as well, because otherwise he's going to just, be mad at me again.
Pimp him? You mean you're selling him on a corner, or what are you?
How much does he go for?
Yes. Wow.
He,
does it come with accessories?
I don't know. You have to ask Samuel, because that's what he wrote in the chat.
Throw me under the bus.
Yes.
Listen,
grip.
I am blushing enough over saying the word Hooters, so I really can't get into this conversation right now.
They're owls. Owls, remember?
Owls,
they're owls.
Yes. And there may even be a dragon. Who knows? it's going to be a lot of fun. But hopefully he's no longer upset with me because I have now said his name on the podcast, and I know I have to get in contact with the Wizards people so he can be on here and give us his great wisdom.
Yes, please.
And who else are you going to pimp while you're there?
While I'm at Gen Con?
Yes. All of the rest of us.
All of you guys.
Podcast. Very good. Thank you. Now.
And I have to wear the t-shirt. I'm thinking that maybe the t-shirt I wear to Hooters, so
that's right,
that'll
baby.
Be good.
Oh, yeah.
Outstanding.
And that's
the pictures would be helpful. So.
Yeah, well, I'm sure there are going to be pictures.
Lots of pictures from Hooters. And take some of the game, too.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. You want some of the game? Why?
I really don't. They're just for Randall to look at.
Thaddeus really likes owls.
That's right.
I'm sure he does.
All right, Sarah. Well, you have a good night and get some sleep.
You too.
Thanks. Take care.
Okay,
night.
Bye. So, Sarah's gone. I guess that's the end of the show, huh?
No, you mean that's the end.
That's where most of our listeners are going to stop listening.
Yeah.
Well, like Tracy's gone. I don't need to listen to you guys.
Yeah.
So Thaddeus, you wanted to talk about Dresden Files. Why do you want to talk about
it? Oh, yes, I want to talk about Dresden Files.
Tell us what is so effing awesome about the Dresden Files that you want to talk about it.
Well, the greatest thing about the game so far is I have actually yet to play a session of in-character gameplay, which is – but I'm still completely excited about this game. 2 weeks ago, my Monday night group, the Half-Assed Heroes of Hamlet, and I got together – and actually went
love
through
that name.
Thanks. I didn't actually come up with it. One of the smarter members of my parties. He's a pretty funny guy. I think Jeff or Brent, or maybe it was Rob. I don't know. It could have been anybody who wasn't me. So we got together and actually went through the city creation process of the Dresden Files. And what's unique about that process is instead of the game master sitting down and creating this world filled with NPCs and interesting places to go and quests, the game master sits down with all of the players before they have any of their characters made, and you decide what city you're going to play in. You know, do you want it to be a familiar city? Do you want it to be a city you've never been to? Do you want it to be a city that doesn't even exist? And my group, we picked Portland, which is the city we live in, because we wanted to start with a base of something familiar. And the great thing is I went to Powell's Books and bought three really fun city maps, like one of the really cartoony city maps, one real city map, and then a couple maps of actual, like Powell's, the bookstore has a map of its inside, and there's a couple malls that have maps. So I came with all these basically like map ideas for Portland. And so we sat down and you pick hotspots. You make locations that the characters can visit in the game that are great places for story to take place. And then you actually create the NPCs that inhabit them, and you give them reasons for being in the story. You give them story hooks. So, you know, one of the guys in the story is this like half vampire chick who sells drugs out of the back of this bar. And so that is a hot spot, and it's a threat. And there's also a church that's a really old church here in Portland that doesn't function as a church anymore. But what one of the players knows is that there is a, an ex-knight of the Round Table who lives under the Burnside Bridge, but also spends a lot of time with this church. And so the church is a meeting spot for these, you know, this basically power of good. And so we had a freaking great time just building Portland into a role-playing game.
That was blast. It'd be a blast.
Oh, it was amazing. And they loved it so much that I've actually gotten them to agree to, now that I have a mic capable of recording them, to recreate Portland. So we're gonna trash what we've made. And now that they have a little experience with it, we're all getting back together and we're gonna start the city creation process over with a recording this time. And I'll throw it up on my website. So.
See, now that sounds like a fun process because, I mean, I live in a small enough town. I mean, Topeka is a city, but it's small enough that there are personalities that we each all know. I mean, you know, we've got the Westboro Baptist Church after all here, right?
So, exactly.
Talk about evil cultists on a platter. So, you know, you've got these guys, and I sit outside. My office building is on a main thoroughfare, Topeka Boulevard.
By the way, all Baptists can send their hate mail to Randall Walker at for once, well, it's not me getting the hate mail. I love it.
Well, I'll make a point of clarification. Baptists have nothing to do with those guys. Totally different. They use that name, but anyway. But what I was going to say, I sit in an office building every day, and I can see out. We get these people that I call NPCs that walk by all the time, and they're these personalities. There's this guy that looks like Doc Brown from Back to the Future, right? He's got this white hair that just like everywhere out, you know. And so there's Doc Brown. There's this guy that dances obscenely on the corner. He like holds the American flag and does hip thrusts.
Nice.
Towards the flat. Yeah, weird dude. And he'll go on each corner and then he'll walk off and go down the street somewhere else. You know, we got this guy that runs everywhere, but it's not like a jog. He's like shuffling everywhere he goes. And even when he stops for the crosswalk, he's like moving in place. And then shuffles up.
Any of those people could be an NPC in your Dresden Files game, and you could
exactly.
You know, the guy with the flag could be doing some kind of a ritual, casting a spell every day, and you don't even know it. And
right.
You know, he's out there working his magic, and everybody's just like, "Oh, that guy's crazy," but maybe he's protecting the city. You don't know.
Yeah, I'm totally and digging it. It's yeah.
You know, maybe one day he goes missing, and then bad stuff starts happening in the city, and so suddenly your players are trying to find him, so everything will be right again.
Right.
Has anyone else actually gone through the city creation process?
I don't know.
I played a session, but we actually skipped. My players, for the most part, are very D&D centric. We had tried Savage Worlds maybe a year ago, and it kind of just whimpered and died. And they're pretty hesitant about trying anything other than D&D. So I actually, with a subset of my normal group, we tried to get something going, and as a way to try to speed things up, we actually cut out the city creation and just went to character creation. So hopefully, if this one little scenario that we have working works out, and then the rest of the group buys into it, then we'll start over and do a city from scratch and go that way.
Has anyone else been through that process? Or I know, Samuel, have you played in a game, or is it just the online game that you're about to do?
Just the online one I'm about to do.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
So, and that's tomorrow, right? Are we getting together and doing that tomorrow night?
No, Candace is not available for that.
Yeah,
sad.
Yeah, we got to wait till next week.
next Wednesday.
Yeah. Well, okay then. Mark,
Thaddeus, can I ask you? Sorry.
Yeah, no. Ask away, man. Ask away.
I wanted to ask you a question about the game. It seems to me that the game, unlike D&D, which is pretty much tabletop and you got to have miniatures, things like that, Dresden Files, I get the feeling you could almost sit in a living room and have a little flat place to roll your D6s or whatever, but you could really play it just sitting in your living room without having to have a whole lot of setup. Am
right,
I correct?
Yeah. Yeah,
you are definitely
exactly.
Correct.
Everything that's required for this game is, it's a list of, it's a two item list. You need the Dresden Files rules, the RPG
right.
rules, which you can get in book format for, I think, $49. Is that right?
Yeah, 40 for 49. The core rules.
No, it's $49.99 is the price on the back of the book.
Yeah.
But you can also buy it for like 30 or something like that, PDF style. So if you don't need the book, if you're down with PDFs, you can get it even cheaper.
The book's a better deal, though.
It's worth getting the books, though. These are gorgeous books.
Yeah, they are phenomenal. And a set of fudge dice, and that's all you need. I mean, the character sheets and the city creation sheets, they have copies of them in the back of the book, but you can also download them off the website.
You also might want to get tokens for fate points, but even that's kind of...
But you could...
Poker chips or something like that.
Yeah, you could make that anything. You know, they could you could have some spare change from around the house, and then if your players don't want to spend fate points, they maybe walk away with an extra dollar that night. Who knows?
or they reach into their wallet and start paying you.
Yeah. Ooh. Or the
yeah, that'd be
walk
pretty.
Away a little,
See, that's a way to get compels, because when you compel an aspect, you have to give them a fate point.
Yeah,
so if you've given them change every time you compel an aspect, you know. They may let you walk all over them.
So, and that brings us up to what is an aspect? Does it? A lot of the creation, both the city and the character creation for this game, is based on these things called aspects. And who here has a good grasp on what those are?
I think I have a decent.
Well, I think. Oh, go ahead.
No, by all means, Mark, go right ahead.
An aspect is essentially a tool you want to use to give yourself. Power in the game, and also to challenge yourself in the game. So you normally want to, at least they suggest in the book, you want a aspect to be like a double-edged sword. Like
so an aspect is something you give yourself?
Yes. And during character creation, I believe you create, essentially establish seven aspects for your character. Everything from which is very useful, is the high level, what they call the high level theme. And that's probably the easiest one, what I use actually to compel to start the game off, because it's essentially you're saying you're going to be a wizard detective, or you're going to be a
werewolf. Oh, like a werewolf bus driver would be one, right?
Exactly, and it's something that is a very high level, but it also establishes their kind of their goals and what they're all about. And
it's definitely a way to establish the identity of the character more than anything.
All right,
right, and throughout the character creation process, which is very interactive, because the characters actually work together and write themselves into stories. Even just a paragraph or so, or less, about what their backstories are, and they write themselves into it, and they start sharing. Essentially, when you're done with character creation process, everybody should have some interaction with at least two other players in the group. And from these little sections of the character creation process, you normally try to grab onto a phrase, a catchphrase that establishes a feel. Usually you try to represent what you had just done. So whose background of your before you got powers, you know, this is kind of like some underlying issues you had back then that still may be haunting you. The more recent ones are things that would have affected you during that little story. And by the end, you have a pretty good idea of what your character is, how they react, and all your friends, too.
Okay.
That's pretty cool. So it sets it up as a framework. It's not restrictive, is it? In other words, because the thing that pops into my head when you say things like aspects is I think those big long lists and the old DM guide about NPC attributes.
Oh, right.
You know,
right.
And how and there's like these huge, it's like volumes of lists about every little aspect, personality, blah, blah, blah. But they seem very restrictive. And is this, I assume it's more organic than that? Or is it really restrictive?
Just before anybody else jumps in, I'll just answer that thing. You make those all up yourself, and there's list to choose from. I'm trying to remember. My wife had one for her character, and it was my cup runneth overwhelmed, and so it essentially was trying to show that her character usually gets into situations where she just gets over her top of their head. I mean, very quickly, which is essentially a cue to me. So when I'm making the adventure, I'm actually working out a heck of a lot of factions and forces that can all come together at the same time to really try to overwhelm the characters, essentially based on that aspect I'm trying to design it.
Cool. Okay. That's all very intriguing. I really want to get the rules.
I was just going to say I had stepped away for a minute, so I didn't know. I don't know if you said this, but when you compel, you're compelling something that you suspect in a lot of cases. So if you're being chased by some thug, or you get in a fight and you end up retreating and you're being chased by this thug, you might take a guess that one of his aspects is overconfident. And so you might compel that and use that trait that you suspect he has against him. And if he indeed has that aspect, then
we haven't actually gotten into what compels are yet. We just discussed what an aspect is. So why don't you tell us what a compel is?
I'll probably get it wrong, but I was just gonna say that, you know, so it's not just your own aspects that are important, but it's what you sort of can intuit from the way someone else is behaving that you might actually be able to cause them to really elicit that behavior, and that's sort of what a compel is, that you see a trait that someone is exhibiting and you basically play on that it's sort of like letting someone hang themselves with their own rope, you know, like you give them enough slack to hang themselves because they're, you know, they'll just go on and go on with their own perfect personality trait and it ends up tripping them up, right? And so you can actually, in the game, you can say, I think, you know, that person has this trait and I'm going to try to play off of that and compel them to trip themselves up with that.
Right, and just to establish the compel is when you use a compel, and in this case, Sam's talking about a player. Correct me if I'm wrong. A player talking to about an NPC, and attempting to guess what an aspect they may or may not have. And of course, usually if it's a good one, the GM will say, yeah, of course, you're right, he had that. But the player has to give up a fate point for this. Mm-hmm. He essentially has to say, hey, here's my fate point, and he gives it to the NPC, which eventually the NPC can turn around and turn it on them. But yes, that's an amazing tool.
I also like to point out that it's not just players and NPCs that have aspects. It's places and even the entire city that you create has an aspect. It has multiple aspects, for that matter. So you can not only compel your opponents or even your fellow players, but you can compel an aspect of the area you're in. I mean, if the area you're in is a rickety old building, you may compel that aspect to have someone chasing you fall through the floor or something like that.
That's right. And so a compel is basically the DM or a player spending what's called a fate point, which is something that is stored up by your player through play to try to alter the course of the story. And so when you compel something, you spend a fate point to try to make something in the story happen. It's almost as if you are in a Dresden Files mystery novel and you're helping to write the story. And so when you compel something, you're basically asking the DM, or the DM is telling you that this is what's going to happen, or I would like this in the story to happen. Here's a fate point. Is it possible for this to play into the storyline? Now, compels also work against the players when a player has a aspect. Say your aspect is, you know, Mark's wife has her cup runneth overwhelmed. Was that it?
Yes. Yeah.
So easily something could be going well for them, or they could be doing something really, really well, and the DM wants to the GM wants to throw in a little twist or make it a little more difficult. He will compel her aspect, which if she accepts that compel, she'll earn a fate point, but then that means that either trouble will brew or something more difficult will come up, and she will begin to become overwhelmed by the story. She can spend a fate point to resist that compel also. So you can alter it either way. You don't have to, it's like in Dungeons and Dragons, being able to step past your alignment or being able to step past what your character said he's able to do in extreme situations. You can spend fate points to get away from being compelled to do stuff. That's kind of a basic of how compels work.
So,
it's an interesting system.
So, I haven't gotten through the rule books, obviously, because I just got them recently. But an aspect is an inherent trait, right? So it's not even something that the player really, or the PC really has control over. Like the player decides, oh, my character is going to have this aspect, and it's sort of going to be this inherent trait, you know, and it's going to play in the game because it's going to be used in fate points and all that kind of thing. But it's really just something that the player picks for their PC and says, this is the type of person my PC is. So how many aspects does one pick when they're creating a character?
All told, you will have seven. You'll end up having a top level aspect, which is called a high concept. You'll have a trouble aspect, and then you'll have an aspect for different parts of your character's life. Like you'll have an aspect for your background. You'll have an aspect for the rising conflict, which is what shaped your character. You'll have an aspect for your story. The game terms it is your first adventure, and then you'll have two aspects which really need more clarification because they're guest star aspects. Part of what I really like about Dresden Files and what gets you connected to other characters is that you have to basically write yourself into the other players' backgrounds. And as part of that, you're going to get an aspect from each one of those other players' backgrounds that you're writing yourself into.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but it's the job of the GM then to know the PC's aspects and sort of make sure that they hit situations where those can be exploited. Is that a correct assumption?
Right.
Yeah. Of a good GM. Yeah.
Yeah, a terrible GM can just ignore all that if they want to.
Yes, right.
I tell you what, though, the more I'm listening to how you guys are describing the game, the less I believe that this is for tactical game players. In other words, there are a lot of people, and I'll admit, my own players in my 4E game like to sit around the board, like to move miniatures, like to see things that are concrete. And this is going to be much more for the conversational, sit around the living room crowd, I think.
It's not a tactical game. I mean, there is combat, but even when you're getting into it, it's more of a narrative description sort of thing than the D&D, here's the battle mat, here's everything, laid out right before you.
Yeah, I noticed, but my group is very visual normally. And so for this game where we played, I knew we were going to have no battle mat. We weren't going to have anything. So I grabbed my daughter's whiteboard, which is like a little easel, and set it up behind me. And I used it to draw out pictures of buildings, top-down views, almost like you would do for miniatures, except it was just a visual to get them a spatial awareness of the situation they're in. I would draw out the symbols of the in this case, we were actually dealing with some gang members from Chicago. And Wikipedia is great for this. I pulled up two actual gangs and pulled out, got all their names and their symbols and put them up on the board just to give them the visual aspect that would be lacking if we just sat around and talked.
Yeah, it's a game
Go for it,
Sam. No, go for it.
I was just going to say that what you're talking about, though, is one of the reasons why I really like the Dresden Files, because I sort of get my tactical battle mat loving, miniature loving, tactical battle power seeking self satisfied with D&D. But I don't. I try to play a game where there's lots of social interactions, but just the nature of the tactical combat in D&D doesn't allow for a large proportion of your game to be social interaction necessarily. And so the Dresden Files, one of the reasons why I'm really intrigued by it and that we're starting up this game, at least for me, is that I want to have a game that basically even the combats sort of play out as these kind of social conflict, fate point trading, compelling aspect interactions. And it's not tactical at all in terms of a battle mat with a certain distance component and a certain weapon component and all that. So it hits both sweet spots, right? That's one of the reasons I like the Dresden Files idea, is that it's so different from D&D. It's not tactical at all. Aaron, what did you?
I was gonna completely agree with you. I mean, I like D&D for what it is, but it's nice to have something entirely different with Dresden Files, and it's not as far, it's not completely opposite of what D&D tends to be, but it's pretty close to it, and it's nice to have that kind of. Whereas D&D's a tactical combat, it's definitely an adventure kind of game. Dresden Files is a very narrative, story-driven, character-driven game. I mean, it's got a different emphasis, and I really enjoy that.
I think, don't get me wrong, I think they both have a place. I think that's an excellent thing. But it does sound like, though, that the people that will want to play this game will probably be there's a certain art and a knack to storytelling. And if you're not comfortable with it, you're not going to like a game like that. So it's, just for the benefit of the listeners, to help describe it. I'm trying to put this in such a way that I don't come off elitist, but I don't think I'm going to be able to succeed at doing that.
So we'll just label you elitist now. Go ahead.
Yes.
Yeah, that's fine. There's going to be a level
You know what, Randall? Randall, that's your aspect in this podcast.
There you go. Elitist snob. No, but I guess what I'd say is that there's going to be a certain level of literacy that's really going to be required to play this. Because otherwise you're not going to get it, I mean, it's easy to sit down at a board and say, well, my piece can move this way and do this and has this kind of damage and I roll this dice for this, etc. But unless you've got a good grasp of, you know, story and narrative and things like that, then it becomes a bigger challenge. I'm not saying it's impossible, but I'm saying that, you know, if you're not already inclined towards that, it may be difficult to get into the game, if you will. That's my assessment.
So,
I mean, I don't
know
if that's true or not. I don't have, you know, actually sat down, read the rules myself. So, you know, I'm only going by everything else that ever the people are telling me. But
my feeling on that would be, I really liked Mark's idea of the whiteboard, which is kind of the way that we're going with it. And any place that we've created that I can get a map for, like Powell's Books, has this really nice full color fold out map of their bookstore, and it's. I don't know if any of you guys know what Powell's City of Books is, but it's basically this city block-wide, four-story bookstore that is just huge.
Oh, cool.
And, wow. Yeah, it is amazing. If you're ever on the West Coast, you wanna stop by Portland and go to Powell's. It's phenomenal. But they have this nice full-color, fold-out map of their bookstore that has all the books, all of the different reading sections all colored out and all that kind of stuff. And so my intention is to basically kind of map out if there's a combat in that bookstore, any kind of an action scene, it's going to go down on that map. But instead of everyone having to move like 6 squares or, you know, oh, I can move 5 squares and that means I can't reach the guy in time. It seems like it lends itself to the idea of more cinematic combat instead of more rigid combat, which I'm hoping people who are tactical but hate the confines of having such rigid rule sets will enjoy. I like the idea of someone being able to say, you know, I do a backflip, right? You know, I jump over this bookshelf and swing my sword around and just hack at him, or I, you know, cast this magic spell and I try to bounce it off a wall. And there are no defined rules for that kind of stuff. And so it really seems like it's limited by their imagination and how well, if they can explain it well and why I should allow it to happen and maybe throw a fate point into it, then chances are they're going to be able to do a lot cooler stuff than just swinging their sword at somebody or, you know, I use Sly Flourish or I use this power and then rolling some dice. That's what I hope. That's what I'm excited for, is that.
Let me ask you a question. Oh, go ahead.
You may lose a little bit of the tactical rule structure, but I think you gain a lot in the idea of a cinematic play out.
Well, let me ask you a question about that very thing then. You're talking about, when you talk about describing things that happen in the game, whether they be the effects of spells or whatever, do you have a tendency, and I'm not putting a value judgment on these, I'm just curious, do you have a tendency to either try to use real world physics when you can, given that spells are magic, but do you try to use real world physics, or do you find yourself defaulting to things that you've read about it in D&D before?
I don't want to say I default to real world physics. I would rather default, and I don't know, I haven't played this game yet before, so, you know, we'll really find out later when the rubber hits the road, but I like the idea more of defaulting to movie magic, you know, the idea that 6 guys can sit there and fire machine guns at you, but if you run at just the right time, none of the bullets are going to hit you, and then you're going to be able to duck behind a desk, which obviously shouldn't deflect machine gun fire, but it will, and then you can pop up and shoot guys one at a time. That is, I think, what I'm looking for in a fun cinematic style role-playing game. I don't want to sit there and shake my head every time and be like, no, you couldn't dodge all those bullets, so you're going to get shot up, or, you know, no, you couldn't bounce a fireball off a wall because it's a wall, it would just catch on fire. But I mean, if they're willing to throw a fate point into it, or if they get a really good roll, I'm going to let it happen. Screw physics. Physics has no place in a game where werewolves are driving school buses and you're shooting, you know, fireballs and all sorts of stuff like that. So,
well, I was just curious because I think part of the – when you start talking about things – like, and I do this all the time. If there's a spell-type effect in the movies, I will go, oh, that reminds me of Magic Missile, or, oh, that reminds me of Fireball.
Does it never miss? Is that why it reminds you of Magic Missile?
Well, not necessarily that, but in other words, you know, because I've been involved with D&D for so many years, and that seems to be my default set of things that to compare to, it, you know, I have a tendency to want to do that. And so I was just curious. I mean, it's a well-established thing, so it's hard to you know, erase all of that background knowledge and take it all from scratch. And I was just curious as to how you handled it. I can see where you go with the what I call movie physics, because that, I mean, that's a good way to run, you know, a cinematic game. So
yeah, everybody wants to live with movie physics. It would be awesome. Yeah.
It's all in the reflexes, man.
Yeah.
I wanted to go back, take a couple steps back and try to say something about what Randall had said earlier, that he thought would make him sound elitist. And I want to try to make it sound not as elitist.
Thanks. Anything you can do to help you there, that would be awesome.
Isn't that pretty much everything he says?
Oh,
yeah, well, that's because it's his aspect, but that's beside the point. My aspect, I guess.
Sharp blow to the groin.
Elitist gamer. That's the good aspect.
No, my two aspects. My first one is the negative. I'm not a good moderator. And the second one though is that I can redeem that by helping others, by mediating their aspects. So, I just want to say, I think the way to think about it is not necessarily that it's like an elitist, oh, you have to be really literate to play this type of game. I think it's more like, you know, when you sit down and you play something like Dungeons and Dragons, if you are really tactically minded, there's something in the game there for you where you can really shine at that point. And even if you're not good about the sort of social interaction or the role-playing part of the game, you really can shine at the tactical battle scenes, right? And then you can sort of sit back and let the other players do a lot of the role playing, and you can maybe do, you know, 10% role playing and 90% tactical items in D&D. But in a game like the Dresden Files, while you do have what Thaddeus described and you have these cinematic fight scenes, and you would consider that role playing, it's not going to really highlight your tactical savvy. So someone who really enjoys D&D just for the tactical components is probably not going to be well suited to this style of game. And that doesn't really have anything to do with literacy. It has to do with where someone shines and where their talents are and how much they're willing to open up and do some sort of heavy duty role playing that's not tactically based. Versus, you know, D&D, where you can pretty much spend 90% of your time doing the tactics for the group. I just think that the focus of the two games are very different. And so I'm not sure it's a literacy issue. I think it helps in this game if you're well read and you've had a lot of different experiences and you've seen a bazillion movies or you've read a bazillion books. I think it helps, of course, where that doesn't necessarily help you in D&D. So there is a literacy component, but I don't think it's a necessary component that if you're missing it, you're going to suck at this game. I don't think that at all.
Well, and keep in mind that I wasn't speaking of literacy and the fact that people who can't read can't play the game. That's the
one. No. I know.
I want to make sure that was clear. But what you said, yeah. So whether or not that, having a good culture, you know, pop cultural background, you know, that kind of thing, and, you know, and like you said, being well read and things like that would have, you know, a stronger influence. But yeah, I was just curious. Like I said, I haven't read the rules myself, so I can't really say, I can't make a firsthand judgment and say, wow, this game wouldn't really be for you or for this person because of who they are for this reason. So, but I was just, you know, trying to find out based on what I was hearing from everyone else. So
yeah, no. Well, Aaron, did you have something that you wanted to jump in with, Aaron? Sorry, I thought you.
I did. Comparing the two games directly are kind of apples and oranges because they have a very different framework to begin with. D&D is very structured. It's class and level. I mean, it's you pick a class, you pick your race, and you've essentially right there, you've defined about 80 or 90% of who your character is right there. With the Dresden's Files, you have so much more freedom to pick whatever you want to be. And to some extent, that's actually it can actually be a detriment because you're given so many options. You have such freedom that unless you really narrowed things down, you might, you know, drown in all those options. So in that case, in that respect, D&D is pretty nice because it gives you, it's very structured. It's got your options laid out right before you. Dresden's Files doesn't. And for some people, some people having all that freedom is not what they really want. They want something very structured. They want to be able to look at something and understand it right away. Dresden Files may not be that sort of the game for them. So it's not just a matter of the tactical or the combat aspect, but it may just be the freedom to do whatever you want. Some people may not find that appealing. Some people may find that considerably more appealing than what D&D offers.
So I think you kind of struck a chord on just one of the things that the game is, and that is I think the Dresden Files is an exercise in really kind of free creativity versus playing in a game system that is just structure and systems. Because in the Dresden Files, you know, when you're making your character, you have this huge freedom to pick all of your aspects and kind of create your story. And once you step past that into the actual generation of your character's powers and whatnot, you're still very free to create that kind of stuff. When you pick all of your powers and your quote unquote stunts piecemeal. And so you're not always limited to just one type of powers, like tank powers or defender powers or healer powers or any of that kind of stuff. You just you get to pick it out piecemeal. But not only that, but when you're creating your powers, you write your own flavor text. You know, when you make a wizard, you kind of write your own spells. They give a lot of examples as to how magic works and what kind of spells there are. But there's no just general fireball. You know, there's no magic missile. If you have an attack spell, you kind of write how is it that you're manipulating magic, what kind of element are you using, and how are you making it. You could be making fire arrows or fireballs, or you could be making fire golf balls and hitting them with a golf club for
awesome.
All they know. There's no defined way that the powers work, and it's very similar to like reskinning in fourth edition, but you don't even start with something to reskin. You basically start with, well, this kind of magic is a this level weapon, so it will do in this range of damage. Now you tell us, how do you conjure it? What do you need to conjure it? And then, you know, what does it do when you conjure this magic?
So, you know, that was one of the aspects what I think struggled a lot with at first. Because I'm computer programmer, very literal. I want to know all the mechanics. And I spent a lot of time on the message boards discussing, like, key edge concepts. And I'm finally wrapping my head around the idea of this. The freeform nature really is something that can be a detriment if you're too locked into it, I think, like I did. And one of the things that gets me is I think, okay, well, if there's a modifier, if there's a combat modifier, like it's dark, yeah, I want that +2 because let's say if pizza gives you a protection, right? I should have it the whole time. And fate is more like it's actually not going to affect it until a key moment that you choose it to. And you're going to usually have to burn a fate point or make a roll to establish it. And then it usually goes away unless you are the next turn you want to do it again. So I was having a bit of an issue kind of come to grips with that, because I started looking at all the cheat cases that you could possibly do. It's like, well, what if you do this? And it really comes down to there's a lot of freedom in your descriptions, but a lot of times if you really want it to make it a big enough aspect that it actually affects your die roll, you know, you're going to have to make a key aspect on it. And you're gonna have to use a fate point, or if you make a roll to get to that aspect, then you get at least one free. And it was something that I was, you know, took I think the longest to get a handle of, especially how magic interacts with that.
So are you saying that it's min-max proof?
Actually, you guys are your comments and Randall's question is actually segueing into my question, and that is. You know, I'm primarily a Dungeons & Dragons player, and Dungeons & Dragons is a very crunchy system. And even though it's got a very few set of rules, and everything else are the exceptions, and so it's an exception-based system, and it's got 1,000 exceptions that you have to learn about and follow, I consider that a very crunchy system, because everything has a mechanical rule attached to it. But is Dresden Files a crunchy system? Does it have a min-max ability? Does it have, you know, things that are pure crunch that... that are going to affect your system in terms of a very mechanically crunchy way that doesn't have anything to do with the storytelling?
Well, yeah. There's, I mean, it's not min-max proof in just the sense that your characters can be well-rounded. I mean, you can have social plus very skilled characters and you know, have some good powers at the same time. Or you could really dump everything you get in your character creation into one side of the character or another. You could make a really socially balanced or a really socially strong character who has networking skills and people skills and, you know, is just able to blow away social skill challenges. Or you could make a really combat oriented player who's just, you know, insanely powerful with powers, and, you know, has skills that are basically all oriented towards doing a lot of damage or moving very quickly. But I think that it not being a tactical game really takes you out of portions of the game for long periods of time. And this is all speculation, seeing as how I haven't played yet, but it seems like it'll sideline you more than it would in Dungeons and Dragons.
I think
go ahead, Mark.
I was going to say like I said, I'm only having two players right now, and both of them chose skills that they try to push their max number of high power skills. They pretty much went to the max. And it didn't create characters that looked like they're out of balance, unbalanced in what they want to do. But they were running into these social, these other aspects of the skill because of like, let's say, driving skills or scholarship skills, things that they won during character creation they didn't think they would need. It comes out during gameplay because it's so open and so free and it's an urban environment. You could be thrown into social conflicts. You could be thrown into times you're going to need to use, you know, like history checks or like all these other types of skills that I think it lends itself to, if a character goes all out, they may be hampered more than in D&D. You know, if in D&D, if you max out your character for max damage, it's depending on your campaign and all your friends and your group, it may not affect you much. I think in Dresden it will self-regulate because it's such an open environment where things can come at you from left and right.
Yeah, there are some mechanics that help characters become more diversified, as opposed to just picking one or two skills and pumping them up as high as you can. It's not foolproof. I'm sure that within days of the book coming out, people found ways around it. But I think they're enough to encourage people to avoid the min-maxing and more go for a more general skill set.
And considering their magic system, I think the crunchiest part of the game is I'm going to pronounce this wrong, but I believe it's thaumaturgy.
Yeah.
It's essentially many, many pages that explain how you can break every single rule in the game and show you. And it's very complex at first. When I was first looking at it, it was kind of put me over my head, but essentially it says, okay, think of anything you ever want to do and you can do it. And then it gives you an idea of how you can break down the problem of the spell essentially into, how to establish a point cost for it. And then it tells you how to get to that point cost and then you can go for it. And so essentially they built into the game something that will break every single rule. You could do anything with this and they have a way to break it down. So, and I think that whole breakdown part is probably the crunchiest part. It's the hardest to wrap your head around. But once you get it, it's actually a very simple mechanic. You decide what you want to do. Find out how many points you should take. Here's the steps to go about it. Roll the dice, usually many times if it's really powerful, and there you go. So the game is designed to be able to, you know, rip people's hearts out from halfway across the city without them knowing it. It's just you're going to have to do some story-wise stuff to actually get to that point.
You're also going to have to break some of the laws of magic, which will earn you, you know, some pretty bad story wrath.
Exactly. Yeah, I think it puts you in check with a lot of narrative things in the game. It's based off the fiction of the books, and it helps bring things into balance. The wizards are so powerful in the game. It's just they can do anything. They are balanced essentially by other wizards who will rip your head off if you break the rules.
Yeah, it was when the game first came out. The first thing I did was like take this and watch the series on Netflix and watch them all. And it was too bad it was only one season because it was a pretty darn good television series.
Yeah, it was really good.
But after that, I of course went straight to Wikipedia and looked all about, you know, the different aspects that were in the book and stuff, and all the different organizations and groups and things like that. And there's a lot of rich material there that's, you know, like you said, for story, that's just fantastic. So it reminded me a little bit of Harry Potter meets Mike Hammer. So, that's a really crude, but that'll be my link into it. But yeah, that's what it kind of reminded me of. Before I do anything else, Fred, who wrote that? Who wrote it? The RPG? Who wrote
Fred Hicks?
And Rob Donahue.
Yes.
Okay, we should get their response to this particular podcast. It would be nice to find out if they've got any insight, since they're both on Twitter.
Yeah,
So let me state all the particulars about that. Then the Fudge system is developed by Stephen O'Sullivan, and the Fate system, Fate stands for Fantastic Adventures and Tabletop Entertainment, is a system by Evil Hat Productions, which basically is Fred Hicks and Rob Donahue. And they're also the people that wrote Spirit of the Century, if anybody recognizes
that. I've heard
of it. Yep. Yeah. So, and you know, there were a lot of people that worked on this set. You know, the lead system developer was Leonard Balsera, and the project developer was Ryan Macklin, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, it's based on Jim Butcher's book. So, it's got some really high level, you know, people that have worked on this that are really good game designers. I mean, you know, it's a beautifully laid out system, and it's the books are just absolutely fabulous. And shit.
What happened?
Yes.
I show a bunch of people offline. Okay. Oh. Never mind. I guess you're all still here. Anyway.
Yeah.
Am I still recording? I am still recording. Ooh, that's very strange. Anyway, so I now that I've said all of the or some of the important people, Aaron had a comment, I think.
I was going to say that in terms of power and keeping balance and min-maxing and all that, there's also built into the system is the fact that the more powerful your character is, the less kind of narrative control they have over what's going on in terms of refresh rates. If you're a wizard, you're not going to have nearly as many fate points as someone who's just a plain Jane mundane human. So that helps balance it out some too. I mean, you may have all these really awesome, nifty supernatural powers, but you may not be able to compel aspects very often. You may find yourself compelled very often and unable to do anything about it, whereas your regular person who doesn't have any powers whatsoever can exercise a lot of control over how the story goes what their role in it is.
That sounds like a good balance, because you have people who are really powerful, like wizards, who aren't as in control as they really think they are, whereas the ordinary person on the street, who all this stuff suddenly starts happening around or whatever, is in more control of the story. That's a very interesting mechanic.
Yeah, they term it as choice. The more supernatural you are, the more powerful you are, the less choice you have. And that's something that goes back to the books. Powerful creatures are forced to act by their natures, whereas humans aren't, and that gives them a lot of flexibility, so to speak, and that's reflected in the game system.
Cool. That's neat. Well, it's on my list of acquires. I've got other things I got to get with limited budget, but boy, I really want to get a set of that rules. It's supposed to be pretty cool. So,
Yeah, it's a fantastic system from what I've read so far, and of course talking to all of you tonight, I'm even more convinced that it's something that I'm going to run this game, and everybody but Randall, I think, that's on this call is in the game. Randall, you want to join the game?
I actually really wish I could. I've just got so many oars in the water right now. I have a feeling it would create conflict if I tried to add another game. So,
yeah. I know the feeling. Trust me. No problem. So I think we should start to wrap up. It's almost been 2 hours. So, are there any final thoughts that anybody has, and then we'll sign off.
Yeah, I'm pretty much jealous and angry at everybody who gets to go to Gen Con.
Yeah, I'll second that. Yeah,
we are the left behinds, and we will be heard.
Yeah,
yeah. Though Thaddeus, at least you and I get to go to PAX later. So
yeah, yeah.
PAX. I will raise my fist to the sky and say, "Wait until next year."
Yeah, yes. we'll take over Gen Con next year with a vengeance.
Yes, it will.
Yes.
But,
all right. Well, thanks, everybody, for being on. And thanks, Mark. This is your first time on the DM Roundtable. So.
Thank you.
Well done. Very informative information. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, have a good time listening to our next podcast, I guess, because you've already listened to this one. So. I did want to go out on a note that I did shoot Rob Donahue a direct message on Twitter to see if he wanted to come on. It seemed like he was excited to last time I talked to him about it, but I just didn't ask him about tonight's show.
Yeah. Even if he's not able to make it on, it would be nice to have them listen, and Fred Hicks as well, and then and just have some responses, you know?
Well, they seem pretty cool about going on. I listened to one podcast, Fear the Boot, with Fred Hicks on it, and he seemed pretty keen about going on podcasts and answering questions and stuff, so... So we're awesome. We're calling the two of them out right now and challenge them to show up on this podcast, because if we didn't do a good job of making the game sound good to people, maybe they can come on and do it, because it seems like it's a freaking sweet game and I'm excited to play it. So
yeah,
I can't wait to start.
All right. So wait, one last thing. So Randall's aspect is elitist, and Thaddeus, your aspect is now piss people off.
That's me, baby.
And my aspect is bad moderator.
At least it's consistent.
Yeah, I think Tracy's aspect is blushing, or I don't know what, indignant. I don't know.
I think it's more sure. Blushing. The indignant is kind of a new thing.
Yeah, Aaron, what's your aspect?
I don't know. I'd have to ask you guys what you thought it was.
Undecisive.
the listener, because so many of the podcasts, all they could do is hang out in the background and listen. I like the listener.
Yeah. Mark, what's your aspect?
I would say I'm blanking. So
guest host.
Easily flustered. Yes.
Easily flustered. Yeah, that's a good one.
There it is.
All right,
everybody.
All right,
gentlemen, thank you very much.
We'll talk to you next time.
A lot.
Night, everybody.
Take care.